Eric.
Hey, Charles, how are you doing, man?
Great. So we're at JAU again.
Yes, yeah.
Where are we? Our host, 2008?
Yes, again, like the last year. And, you know, like last year, we have to say a guest, Dave Thomas, again.
Excellent. How you doing,
great.
Dave?
Great to be back with you, Charles.
Right on. Great to see you. And we have a new face here.
Yes, and I'm Pratap Lakshman. This is my first visit to JAU.
Yeah? And what do you do?
I work in the JScript team in Microsoft.
Okay.
So I work some on the runtime, some on tools, and of late I'm getting involved in the direction in which the language is evolving.
The language is evolving,
yeah.
Huh? Interesting. So this is great. So let's talk about JavaScript. It's a very strange, funky language.
Yep.
Super dynamic. Lots of people use it. Doesn't seem to ever go away. Let's talk about JavaScript.
Yeah. Well, so JavaScript, I think, you know, sometimes it's described as the scheme's evil cousin. You know, it's like scheme with curly braces.
Uh-huh.
Extremely flexible language. Like, you know, I think maybe the world's most widely used programming language. It's, you know, every web page has it. You know, there's a lot of little scripts written in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the web relies on JavaScript everywhere. So, and, you know, and it's not going to go away.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's actually it's kind of cool language. I mean,
it's very dynamic.
From a geeky point of view, it's fascinating.
Excellent.
And of late, you're seeing that multiple vendors are pushing JavaScript performance to the limits.
Yeah.
JavaScript has, like Eric says, it's got a lineage that can be traced back to Scheme, to Java for syntax, to Self for prototype-based inheritance and all that. And it stands to reason that many of the techniques that were used to make those systems run fast apply to JavaScript also. Things like techniques that have been borrowed from StrongTalk and from fast self-reent and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing more and more of them being applied to make JavaScript run faster in the browser.
Absolutely.
I think the big surprise in JavaScript is that most professional developers really, you know, turn up their nose. I know I wrote an article that a year ago,
yes,
real men don't do JavaScript, and I got a lot of hate mail for
I'm
that.
Sure you did.
And fortunately, as predicted in that article, the language was being extended by Javanauts to have types and generics and all the other things that nobody can actually use to make it look like C# and Java, which are also very hard to use. And that effort's been terminated now. So,
you were right.
So I'm pleased that the users actually were saved the benefit of having to have yet another useful language turned into another complicated object language. But I think the real exciting thing is with JavaScript moving ahead now, things like the efforts that Microsoft and others are working on, but I think the hot item here at JAU is the Google V8 VM, which basically uses classical sort of small talk style implementation techniques for a very simple, well-engineered VM with very, very good sort of overall performance characteristic that kind of punches a hole in the space, plus open sourcing that even opens the opportunity for doing basically using web tools to build embedded applications. And this puts punches a hole and puts Java on the client to bed forever, and certainly makes opportunities for things like V8-based app engines and so on. So I think for all those folks that watch Channel 9, these guys next to me better be doing running hard to make sure they get their act together, you know, or else Soma's going to miss the boat, and along with those other people who are chasing the DLR and those little bolted add-ons. You know,
sure.
This stuff is going to take real men that builds real dynamic languages.
Well, that's interesting. That's fair enough. So let's talk. I mean, you're in the hot seat. So let's talk about it. The fact of the matter is that V8 is very much faster than anything else on the market right now today. That includes the engine in IE8 that we just released, the beta version.
Right.
Now, not that we're not necessarily working on something, we can't talk about that. I don't know anything about that. But my point is, how come they can get it done in 2 years? And we've had a browser for 10 years, and our engine has always been pretty slow. And this is true for Firefox as well. I'm not ragging on my own company.
Right, right. So, first of all, we can't disclose what plans we have to respond to what V8 and TraceMonkey and SquirrelFish Extreme are doing.
Yeah.
But I think one of the key things that that is very specific to the engine that ships with the IE is the amount of compact that we need to keep in mind. We have to keep in mind that literally no web page can break. We have about 10 years, like you say, 10 mm-hmm. years worth of scripts out there, scripts for which authors may not be around still, mm-hmm. scripts which cannot be changed,
yeah.
and so on and so forth. We have this incredible compact burden that we have to keep in mind. So that is, you can think of it as protecting the value that is users have created. At the same time, it's an anchor that we have to drag along with us. So
absolutely.
We are thinking of ways in which we can overcome that. Let's see how it pans out.
No, I mean, that's a great point. It's an excellent point.
Yeah, so another thing you have to keep in mind is that, you know, when JavaScript came, you know, or the web started, JavaScript was not kind of, you know, people didn't imagine that they would write whole apps in JavaScript, right? It was like, you know, to make something blink or whatever.
Sure.
So a lot of the kind of existing engines are optimized for that scenario. And you know, so it has been kind of stretched way past its kind of original yep. kind of, you know, use case.
Absolutely.
And now, you know, so now we see things are catching up because people are kind of using it.
Yep.
And that said, you can make the execution fast, but still I think JavaScript itself has a lot of weaknesses to make it really into a language or a platform for building apps. For example, there's not a lot of libraries, standard libraries. I mean, a lot of the value, say, for .NET and Java is not in the language or the VM. It's in the class libraries, right? Because, you know, Anders had a nice slide about it yesterday. Like, you know, the languages really have not evolved very much, but the class libraries, that's where a lot of the innovation goes.
Sure.
So with JavaScript, we don't have that. And then, of course, there's other things in JavaScript. It's like to build apps like encapsulation, there's no such thing as strong naming, so you cannot just, like, you know, load Dave's libraries and Pratap's libraries into one app because now you get all kind of name clashes and so on. So I think we need a lot of innovation also besides kind of having faster VMs.
Absolutely. That's right. True. Absolutely right. Like Eric says, some of the uses for which JavaScript is being put to today, arguably the language was not designed for that. The kind of use that you know, Volta, the kind of use cases that Volta exposes JavaScript to, it stresses code paths in the engine which are not at all geared for that kind of workloads. Mm-hmm. So definitely the language itself has to evolve. And as we've just seen in the Google V8 talk,
mm-hmm.
VMs and techniques used to make the language run faster, even they need to evolve. So there has been a beginning, a start made. Let's see how everybody else catches up now.
That's interesting. I mean, because talking to Martin yesterday, and of course we were talking about DSLs,
sure.
which he loves to talk about and clearly is incredible in that space. But, you know, it really kind of sort of begs the question, if JavaScript is going to be a general-purpose programming language, then it should be a general-purpose programming language.
Mm-hmm.
It seems much more like a DSL, like a big bloated DSL that's geared towards the web, where that's the domain. And of course, I'm not in talking about Martin's definitions of DSL, which are very narrow. So let's talk about that. I mean, is it a general-purpose programming language or not?
So JavaScript is a general-purpose programming language. The only thing that particularly orients it to the web is the fact that it has to speak to the stupid DOM. And most of the problems attributed to, many of the problems attributed to browser programming are actually due to the browser host and the DOM itself, you know, and because that's where a lot of the bugs are and the complexity is and the differences, you know, compatibility across. So many of the things that have been sort of thrown at JavaScript programming are actually the frustrations of dealing with the browser as a runtime environment and the DOM itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, JavaScript is a real programming language. You know, one can debate the syntax, but at least you don't have to indent with spaces and
sure.
You know, doesn't start in column 7. You know, it's, you know, syntax is reasonably easy to type. You can do full object-oriented programming if you want. There are getting to be more libraries. One of the problems is there hasn't been an environment that made libraries worth writing. Again, not to plug V8, but because they've written a lot of their code that normally is hard-coded in the JavaScript engine, move that into libraries. This gives a lot more flexibility. Their debugger, for example, is dynamically, lazily loaded, and uses a library. So this now means that you can deliver it, and effectively JavaScript becomes a target language for lots of people. If you want to have a DSL, mm-hmm. an implementation technology for a DSL is you can generate JavaScript instead of generating C# or mm-hmm. or another technology. So I think like it or not, whether it's basically a full-blown language, and I think that there's a wonderful paper by Doug Crawford, basically the world's most misunderstood programming language, where he shows how it is a lot like Scheme, and they're perfectly good style and checking tools, and I think this will also drive the provision of good tools. On the other hand, and just to go back to this library point, I think one of the problems is with OO is the bad news is you are completely hooked on the library. We give you an OO language, and then we sell you the drugs, right, which is the library. And so you basically can't switch vendors. You can't even switch versions between one and the other because there's so many classes and so much surface area. So I think one of the challenges in building JavaScript libraries is how to make those libraries very simple and very thin, mm-hmm. so that you don't have the API field of dreams where, here's another 3,000 APIs. Well, let's hope the applications will come.
Sure. Now, let's talk about that, because you mentioned OO and stuff, and Lars was saying in his talk, Lars being the chief architect behind V8, and hopefully we'll get him on Channel 9 while we're here, he said explicitly there are no classes in JavaScript. So how are you object-oriented with no classes? Can you explain for the layman?
Yes, sure.
Or the moron like me?
So, what is object-oriented, right? It doesn't mean it has to be class-based. An object is something that has state and behavior, so it doesn't have to have classes. And again, in JavaScript, if you want to have a class-based language, you can encode that in JavaScript. So what Rex said is JavaScript actually is a quite good target language because it's so flexible, because it has no classes, it doesn't impose anything on you. It's very flexible and dynamic. So if you want to build your own style of object-oriented program, and again, Douglas Crawford has a couple of nice papers how to encode a lot of these things. And you can do that in JavaScript. So in some sense, JavaScript is very nice as a target language. I think it lacks a couple of things to be a real good target language. For example, one of the things you can do is what people call monkey patching. So you can if you have an object, so and suppose I build it and now I pass it to you, you can add and remove methods and properties at will. And this is something that something you might want to prevent. Mm. On the other hand, I don't want to have this kind of fixed type system that in the underlying language that now kind of dictates its structure on everything that tries to target it. So we have to kind of have a little bit of flexibility on both sides. Another thing, and you saw that in the V8, JavaScript lacks, I think, numbers. JavaScript, a number type, it lacks integers. So the V8 guys, again, used traditional technology with tag bits, such that if you do integer computations, it's really fast. You don't have to go to this number type. So they're using a lot of standard techniques to make things fast, mm-hmm. where you can use JavaScript as a target language. So it's
very
interesting. Very interesting.
Now,
just going back to the classes, right? You can just think of classes as sugar. So
yes,
already JavaScript has the ability to do encapsulation through closures. It supports full closures. So there is an ability already in place to do encapsulation. You can think of classes as just providing some kind of syntactic sugar to make it, easier to
program.
Program. Yeah.
Okay.
And like Eric said, there are so many other features that could make JavaScript more attractive as a target language. For example, just enabling GoTo, having some kind of a record structure by which you can express how you want an object to be laid out. There are so having better library facilities. Like when you have a program in Java that you're now compiling to JavaScript, how do you map your Java abstractions to JavaScript? Right now, if you have integers that you're using in a source language, once you come down to JavaScript, you have to deal with doubles. So better library support. There are so many such things that can be done to make JavaScript more attractive as a target language.
Absolutely. So Dave, you want to say something?
So, yeah, I think this is obviously the language designers and people who actually want to promulgate the notion of records and, you know, working with bits. I think one of the features is not having those, and certainly my background in small talk and dynamic languages says mm-hmm. that you really want that low-level machinery available outside, but you really want to have a very clean object model inside. It's very simple. So by having a uniform object-based implementation, this makes things very clean and very simple, and then you can add other facilities for dealing with those. And since, you know, you have to live in the C or C++ world, I think one of the dangers is trying to take a simple language and then add all this other stuff. You know, that's like, you know, say C Sharp, for example, started out to be relatively simple, a sort of better Java, and now it's got Link and it's got all these other things, which makes it very powerful. But on the other hand, you know, generics, the barrier for someone learning it goes way, way up, and the complexity and the very subtle interactions, as Eric illustrated in his talk. I mean, very difficult things to resolve and very, very subtle. So I think one of the things we need to learn is how to use the best language for the best job and how to make the couplings between those. So I think one, something that's very, very important is having very, very simple and efficient interfaces between something like JavaScript and the other parts. One of the problems, for example, is if more of the DOM appeared in JavaScript, then that big boundary you go across and a lot of the complicated problems would go away. I think, you know, you can translate between it. I mean, you know, Most programs are going to be talking to this over a wire anyway, so the need for actually, you know, so as long as you have an efficient format like JSON or something like that you can stream it from, then you can easily talk to C Sharp or Java programs or even legacy applications. So I think it's very important that people lobby hard to keep to avoid gratuitous language extensions and sticking complicated types. I think some local type inference, such has been done in the VB and then some of the link work where you do local type inference, helps finds people's errors, gets better code quality, might even help the implementer under the hood do some little cheating to get faster. Those are important benefits, but I think one needs to be very, very careful about, you know, adding language extensions. One of the big features should be, here's the new version of my language, and by the way, these things are gone. Right. Take things out.
But let me ask you. Let me ask you. Going back to the notion of, you know, talking on just, you know, about programming languages now. Can you really have a general purpose programming language? General purpose meaning can solve any number of problems. That doesn't have a lot of features and a lot of functionality. So by adding dynamic constructs and functional constructs to C Sharp, now you have a language where you can do things like link, which can be helpful to a general-purpose programmer. But I'm just asking, can you have a small general-purpose programmer?
Yeah, the answer is that JavaScript actually didn't need to add those. It had most of those capabilities already. So in many ways, in terms of the language spectrum it supports, it was more permissive than C#. And probably you talk to Eric on that.
Yeah, sure, he's going to.
Yeah, so the thing is, like, you know, you don't, usually when a language has a lot of features, it's a sign that the design was not well done, because you only really need very few features to make a language very powerful. And for example, in C#, it took like a couple of generations to add closures. But then you see, once you have closures, that enables link and so on. So it's just the fact that, you know, you have to pick and choose, you know, a couple of kind of abstractions in which you can express all the other things. Mm-hmm. And it so happens that JavaScript has all these things. It has full closures. It had that right from the start. Mm-hmm. So that's why JavaScript is so powerful, because now with the primitives that JavaScript has, you can kind of, you know, build all the other abstractions. Mm-hmm. And so... I think the more powerful a language, it just has a few building blocks using which you can do everything else. And you should not special case by, you know, having little things, like, you know, 20 little features. No, if you have, like, you know, 3 powerful features, you can kind of, you know, express all the others. Then let me say the other thing. It's like this difference between a general purpose language and a domain specific language. That boundary is not very clear, because before you know it, you know, your language has Turing power. Right? Mm. You don't have to have a lot in your language to get there. You know, most simple macro languages or whatever, you already have like all the power that all other programming languages have. So I'm personally not kind of, you know, I don't think this distinction between a general purpose language and, you know, whatever, DSL, mm-hmm. is very fruitful, because, you know, most, you know, languages are, you know, in some sense general purpose.
Okay.
Once you add like conditionals or something, or some notion of like abstraction, procedural abstraction, you have a general purpose language.
Sure, but back on Earth.
Yep.
And what I mean by that is the people that are
you're
here.
You're not saying that I'm kind of, you know, floating up you're there.
You're not lofty or anything. But back,
we know what direction you're going.
Yeah. Yeah.
May not be up there.
But for the everyday programmer, right? The
yes.
people that are at this conference,
yes.
the people that are watching this video, I mean, the people that have to spend their time in some sort of IDE or some sort of environment, they want to be comfortable with the language. So if I'm comfortable with a syntax and a flavor of composition, then am I really going to mind that you add more features to it that actually I'm going to be comfortable with, because the learning curve isn't, say, going from writing Link to, you know, now when I want to implement something like Link, that I have to do it in Haskell and shove it into my program somehow, which of course would be very complicated. But you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I think.
So
but
what's,
so, so
what's
my
wrong?
Answer is, why don't you go and, I don't know the facts, but why don't you look at Microsoft's base and how long it takes for people, how many people are actually using Link or generics or any of the new stuff you put in.
Uh-huh.
My bet is that the experience is, you know, that these things, certainly in the Java community, these things take a long time because people adopt very specific styles. They program based on the examples they're given.
Mm-hmm.
Most people take examples they're given and copy them. There's, you know, it's only the pointy-headed guys, you know, that, you know, understand what generics are or even care that they're there, right? It's the same with many of these. You know, Link, on the other hand, is designed to reach to other people. But the simplicity of VB8 is under, you know, is undersold, or VB9. I'm not sure what the number is now.
Nine, sorry.
Nine,
no. You're confused with V8.
Yeah, that's right. The juice, right?
Yes.
But I think, you know, it isn't necessarily, you know, it isn't necessarily, and like you get a new IDE, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's Eclipse or Visual Studio, what they put all these new features in, and the good news is it's the same IDE, but there's still all these other buttons, all these hotkeys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless something causes you to need these things and go through the experience,
mm-hmm.
just because they're, quote, in the same environment doesn't mean. So sometimes being put in a new environment or having a separate language for describing this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in the just to come back to DSLs,
sure.
In the DSL case, it says if you happen to have a lot of people who express their problem in a very domain-specific way with a, you know, well-known set of nouns and verbs, then that can provide leverage. So if you have 100 or 200 or 300 people in an organization and they write, you know, define insurance policies or rules or various other things like that, then having a language for them, which won't be Turing complete, but is very strong specific for those constructs, gives them great leverage. But as soon as you take a DSL and you make it so you can program loops and so on, you've lost the point
yes.
of the DSL.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think there, you know, JavaScript and other things are general purpose programming languages.
Mm-hmm.
They have a very simple syntax. There are mm-hmm. tools that you can use, maybe not fancy IDEs, but, you know, maybe the reason you need the fancy IDEs because of those bloated libraries, because you can find all this stuff, right? So, you know, people
perhaps.
Can get by, you know. So, you know, I don't think it's the verdict's out. I think it's going to be a challenge to build tools for
mm-hmm.
JavaScript that reflect the kind of use. And if you look at how quickly and how many people learn JavaScript, I mean, there are many universities now where they teach it as a first programming language.
Sure.
And you can actually teach it to both, you know, art students and computer science students, and they both can learn something.
Absolutely.
You know? So I think that's a you know, a great breakthrough. Really.
It's a great point.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is also kind of maybe a secret behind JavaScript is that if you get, you know, when, you know, I was young and probably when you were young, is, you know, every computer had, you know, like BASIC, right? So people could tinker, you know. That's how I learned to program. But, you know, I had an Apple II, and there was BASIC, and you would kind of do peek and poke, and you could write simple programs. Now when you get a PC, it's very, you know, like enterprise-y, right? There's nothing you can really do. Mm-hmm. There's no programming available. The only thing is JavaScript, right? Every computer has a browser. Yeah. In there, you can JavaScript. So in some sense, JavaScript is now the point of entry for people, for kids, to learn to program. So I think that's, you know, and you have immediate satisfaction.
Absolutely.
You write something and you see it on the screen. Right. So it's very low barrier to entry.
I mean, that's a good point. That's the power of JavaScript.
In fact, the R5RS scheme report in the very first paragraph, it cautions against piling on feature on top of feature onto a language. And like Dave says, the challenge for JavaScript is going to be to keep it simple. It has a few flaws, it has a few quirks in it, but we should not add to it. The challenge is going to be, how do you keep it simple? I wish more languages would take the advice given in R5RS. I wish Scheme itself would take that to heart some more. But I think in the as JavaScript evolves, we'll have to keep that in mind. Keep it as simple as possible. Don't destroy the expressivity that is already there in the language. Like, for example, when you have a class-based nominal type system, like you have in, say, C++ or something, very soon you realize that, hey, how do I do collections on it? Then once you start doing collections on it, you find out that it's still not expressive enough, so you have to add some kind of F-bounded polymorphism, you have to add some kind of constraints to it. And very soon you'll realize that you have a type system that the typical average programmer is not able to understand. Mm-hmm. The kind of error messages that you get are mind-bogglingly complex. If you use C++ templates and, God forbid, you have a syntax error or something like that, you know, you don't want to get into that kind of a situation. How do you keep your language simple? That is going to be a challenge for JavaScript as it progresses.
So besides compatibility then, and the fact that there's millions of lines of JavaScript on the web, given that it's been around since the early 90s, why don't we just create a new language? Why don't we learn from what we know and just create a new web language that runs on all platforms that isn't JavaScript?
There have been many. I mean, curl is, for example, a language based on Scheme, sort of turned inside out, done at MIT, which basically kind of combines tech and Scheme as a way to do it. Unfortunately, language success is a sort of a challenge of a good implementation, an emotional audience that grabs it, and somehow a vendor that aligns from it and pushes it forward. And those are the kind of, sort of, you need those three kind of events to really move a language to the mainstream. And so many people design languages, but I think that the success goes to those who implement them. And in many cases, the challenge is accepting the language that's there, because many of the most successful languages, I mean, look at things like Fox and Clipper or any of the 4GLs or all these sort of odds and sods languages, JavaScript, it's just accidents of history that they actually made it out. So, you know, it's hard to design, you know, it's hard to get a really well-designed language commercially acceptable. I mean, Haskell's an example, Scheme, very, very well-designed, Smalltalk as well, that made very, very good inroads commercially, but it's very, or APL, which was very, very well designed, you could argue with the syntactic form and so on, but it's hard to just make it on the strengths of the purity and the excellence of the language design.
Certainly. I mean, Eric would have us all programming Haskell.
You cannot force success, right? That is the thing. It's like, I think a lot of languages is like, it's success by accident. It's like a language that's there at the right place at the right time. It has the right niche. Mm-hmm. And this is where JavaScript, you know, appeared. That was like, you know, they were there first. And, you know, often we think, you know, doing something new, throwing everything away is going to solve all the world's problems. And I think, you know, whenever you start from fresh, there's a reason that languages kind of evolve to where they are.
Okay.
Right? So if you're kind of just starting from scratch, you still have to solve the same problem. So there's no guarantee at all that you end up with something beautiful. But you're just disrupting the whole system by saying, oh, throw it away. Then all these people have to learn things from new.
Right.
All the millions of web pages, you know, that are there, you know, it's also a cultural heritage that we have. I mean, in some sense, you know, I want my kids to view web pages from, you know, from 40 years ago or something like that. So I think there's also, you have a responsibility have this compatibility.
So what you're saying is that JavaScript is going to be the default language for programming the web in 10 years. So I want to ask it. I want to ask a different question because it seems to me that that. I mean, are you gonna say that? 10 years from now, everyone's still programming JavaScript on the web, and I'm not talking about the vendor-specific languages like Java and C# in the form of Silverlight and the Java VM. I'm talking about what everybody can use, a very simple textual-based language like JavaScript.
So in terms of ubiquity, yes, JavaScript has a lot going for it.
And okay.
Maybe not JavaScript in its current form, but some derivative of it would be definitely around in 10 years.
Yeah. I want to make it stronger because look at this, right? We can still, you know, we find some, you know, text written on calf skins, you know, in some, you know, cave, you know, in the desert from 4,000 years old. We can still read that, okay? Now a lot of our cultural, you know, things that we produce as a society are on the web, okay? If we lose the capability to read that, to execute that, we're losing, you know, this is, you know, we have this responsibility to make sure that the artifacts that we produce can be, you know, used and viewed by future generations. So I'm really, we shouldn't take this very lightly.
Sure, well, I mean, solve that problem. You could virtualize that problem away, right?
But how do you virtualize the web? I mean, that is, you know, maybe you can virtualize your DOS program.
You can cohabitate, right? I think you know, Charles's point is that you could have a single or multiple virtual machines that collaborated such that you supported your parents and grandparents and great grandparents while going through with the modern, new, clean, ultimate web programming language.
Absolutely.
I think it's possible because languages appear for, you know, these sort of random events, and there'll be problems that come up. So, but I have no doubt that, you know, like it or not, now that there are real VMs for JavaScript, you might as well learn it because you're going to be eating it for a long time.
and it's not as if languages have, there are no new languages coming about. I think John Samet of IBM had documented maybe 20, 25 years back, more than 2,000 languages in the book that she had written. So there's no shortage of languages as such. Every day somebody or the other invents a language, but it takes a lot for a language to take off.
No.
You need applications for it, you need a very loyal user base for it, you need a vendor who's backing it, you need all the right kind of tools to make sure that the language is usable. So from all those perspectives, JavaScript has got a lot for it going right now. And for the foreseeable future, I think it's going to be around. And like Eric says, it's the web is our memory bank right now. And there's nothing that we should do that will, you know, jeopardize that.
Now, but I would ask this. JavaScript is fundamentally single-threaded. And if you're running a web page on an 80-core machine, how many cores is the web page going to use? How many let's talk about that.
Sure.
It's going to use one.
So if you actually look at the Chrome browser from Google, what they do is they run every page in a separate process. So, you know, that solves one. It's shocking that browsers weren't implemented that to begin with. I mean, I was in a concurrency discussion interview with Guy Steele yesterday, and Guy Steele said, you know, he thought, well, so what, right? I mean, that's no innovation because he didn't know that browsers didn't work that way. Now he was like in shock. Duh. I mean, you know, but so they've got some isolation there. Basically, if one page crashes, it's not a problem. Your other pages are still sitting there. So that's a very simple thing that, you know, it's really a brain-dead design in current browsers that didn't do that. So it always supports. The other thing is you can get concurrency in lots of ways without having to put things in a language. In fact, in many cases, the best thing you can have is an encapsulation. So there's an easy way to encapsulate something and invoke it, maybe with a REST URL or something like that, which causes you to start concurrent JavaScript or any other kind of language thing where you don't have to learn a plethora of machinery, a block and tackle or P and V on this semaphore and all this complicated machinery. And that way you can write a Sequential program, which does this nice thing, and as it collaborates, it can talk to a tuple space or invoke other actors and so on. So I don't see any problem dealing with concurrency either at the thread level or distribution that's inherently a problem with JavaScript. In fact, I think it may be easier if they don't try and put those extensions in the language, but rather put them in a kind of programming facility which encapsulates the body of JavaScript programs and doesn't pollute the language with.
So sort of like a task parallel library for JavaScript.
Yep.
Is what you're saying.
I think it's even different. So I think using a process as an isolation boundary for something that can fail, that protects its own memory and its own data structures. So we're not even talking about task parallelism where the programmer has to think about, I'm going to run this thing in parallel. No, just using tabs, run them in different processes. Yeah. So when one tab kind of goes wrong or, is an infinite loop, it doesn't bring down the whole system.
But let's focus in on one tab. So we have one tab with a bunch of JavaScript in it.
Yes.
And an 80-core machine.
Yes, okay, even there. So imagine you're going and you're going to a web page. It has ads running in JavaScript. You have gadgets, clock, weather gadget, all these things. You want these things to be isolated. I don't want if my weather gadget goes into an infinite loop, that the rest of my page, my ads kind of, freeze. So if you would run each of these gadgets, each little bit of JavaScript in its own process, it's easy to have to keep 80 cores
busy. But who's
doing
that?
No, not yet. That's
okay.
The thing.
That's where we should go. Okay.
There's a lot of things where we can use all these cores to provide isolation.
Okay. And so that would be a change in the virtual machine and not the language.
Yes. And a lot of the kind of inter-process communication you can do, again, with libraries. There's no need to change the language for that. And in some sense, .NET has something like that with app domains, right? App domains are like an isolation unit. And there's just libraries, the app domain API. It's like an object, and you can kind of, send messages across. There's nothing in the language itself that you need to do that.
I agree, yeah. I think Moore's law is now going to apply to cores on the chip. I agree that there's no need to surface it through the language. And even if we do, there are different levels of abstraction at which it can be surfaced. Like, for example, you could think of an if-else condition as one level of abstraction, whereas a for loop as a completely different level of abstraction, which can be realized with this lower level of abstraction. So maybe threads is too low a level of abstraction to surface concurrency into the language. Maybe we need something higher, but it is doable through libraries.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see how
Very interesting.
So there's a very simple way to do this without. One of the big problems is with concurrency models is they disrupt the object-oriented paradigm and they're not woven in nicely.
Mm-hmm.
There is a model called actor model, and there are primitives such as the Thoth and QNX use, where they have a blocking send, a blocking receive, and a non-blocking reply, and an anthropomorphic moment programming model that's very easy to implement. We actually, in 1984, multiprocessor Smalltalk that talked to multiple cores, they weren't called cores, multiple processors, shared memory, soft, green threads, real threads, embedded in hardware that go on a chip.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very nice model. It's very simple because it lets you take a aggressively serial program and gradually transform it by essentially taking those parts that need to be actors and turn them turn them into actors, the parts that need to be concurrent and turn them into actors, and let you actually do object-oriented programming so you can have workers and servers and administrators and secretaries, and a manager just sits in a loop and does nothing and gives works out to workers. So it's a very nice way.
That's a good definition of a manager.
No, that's this programming model is actually very easy to build up concurrent abstraction because it doesn't force you to get into, it's a certain style of programming, but when you program that way, you get a very, very simple model doing it versus all these other things are very, very clever, but they can be quite challenging to try and implement them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think by the time one of the things that, in finance where people pay a lot of money to try and leverage multiple cores. It can take a year or two to get something working for one vendor's multi-core. Mm. You know, by the time that happens, you know, in web time, it's not going to be there. Plus, we just, you know, there's almost all sorts of other things. You know, we can run, you know, we can at 80 cores, we won't need to run monolithic browsers. We'll actually be able to run every window being its own process and its own thread or whatever it is, and be really isolated.
Absolutely.
So I have a question for you all. Do you think a more declarative style of programming would be useful here?
Well, again, you know, maybe now I sound pedantic, but I usually don't know what declarative really means, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like, you know, it's a very ambiguous term. Everybody has a different idea of what declarative means. I do believe that having a more pure programming style where, you know, like, or maybe I say compositional style, where again, you know, I think you have a lot of kind of imperative computations going on, and now you want to kind of glue them together or compose them in a way where the kind of composition doesn't influence the kind of individual computations. That is something that I really believe in. Is that declarative? You know, some people think of declarative if where you have no code. That's not, you know, I think we still need code. You still have to have conditionals because, you know, you want to kind of make a choice, in this case do this, and in that case do that. But I think having the kind of composing your programs at a higher level, that is definitely something that I see happening.
I'd be interested to know what your definition of declarative
yes.
is as well.
Yes.
Not exposing too many of the sequencing elements of execution to the actual computation. So kind of what Eric was talking about expressing separate computations and how you glue them together and then letting the VM or some underlying execution mechanism figure out what cores to run it on and the concurrency model.
Would you consider Scheme to be declarative or Haskell to be declarative or are you looking at something else? I mean, Haskell has the property that the lazy evaluation, you know, obligates the implementer to figure out how to make it work.
So does the scheme,
on the other hand, you know, is still pretty imperative in terms of how you do things. I mean, you can create things as a scheme programmer, which provide, you know, delayed evaluation and engines and things like that. But I'm just trying to get a feeling for what.
So by its nature, doesn't scheme lend itself to, doesn't it abstract away the concurrency of the underlying execution?
No. My answer is no. I think there's nothing I couldn't. I could do anything in JavaScript that I could do in Scheme with regard to the abstractions. I think what it does is you basically use libraries to do the abstraction and macros. You know, so I don't really consider Scheme as providing a declarative language. I think it's possible to make a declarative language that is implemented in Scheme.
Which is
the nice thing of a Lisp community, because the boundary between implementation and representation is invisible.
Right.
Excellent. What about Erlang? Remember Erlang last year?
Yes, I remember Erlang.
There's a lot of work going on the underlying machine with sending messages.
Yes, so again, Erlang is a kind of good example of where you kind of use like processes as a kind of, you know, control structure and or as an isolation mechanism. So there what you do is, you know, you spin off a process, that's an isolation boundary, and you send messages to it. If that process goes down, you know, it doesn't take the rest of the things go down. So again, using these cores as an isolation mechanism, as something where, you know, it makes it really cheap to kind of, you know, start something, run it if it goes down, you know, forget it, you know, start up something new. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, where we need to go.
And that's a great pattern. Why aren't we going there? I don't understand.
Well, I think we are in some cases, but, you know, Erlang is wonderful, but, you know, it's also designed specifically for things that happen to look, you know, where that pattern's very prevalent. Mm-hmm. I mean, telco for years have been built, you know, the design pattern telco switches is asynchronous state machines, which is the lower level technology to build this. But that, using that, only that design pattern, you know, put telcos in a gridlock because they couldn't build simple services on top of this because those two had to be asynchronous. And they can be quite complicated to design. So, you know, having everyone program with continuations, which could also be done in Scheme or other things, right? You know, it can get pretty hairy. I mean, you know, the answer is, so one of the issues is a lot of these things, you have, see a language and you find it at its sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if the sweet spot is natural concurrency, then it's going to look really good. But when there's a lot of serial stuff, like having Erlang talk to the database and get the service provisioning stuff and things like that, that turns out to be pretty hairy stuff because there's all these stateful sinners going on, right? Mm. You know? So that's more of a challenge.
Excellent. Well, to be honest, I could just keep this conversation going on and on and on, but, you know, we probably do have to have a reasonable interview here.
Yep.
We'll get you guys again more. I'd like to maybe get other people involved.
Yep.
And Eric's definitely going to be leading us around and meeting people. We got to get Anders in here as well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Now I just put myself on the spot. So it's great to meet you.
Yeah.
I've heard about you. Now we met you. And thanks for coming
on. Thanks a lot, Charles. Great to be with you again.
I hope to be here again next year. Now, let's talk. I mean, do you come to every JAL or what?
Yeah, well, I'm actually on the program committee for JAL. So we try and find unique speakers every year, people who have, as you may have noticed, a bit of an edge and
absolutely
not afraid to express it, because I think that's how we all get better as professionals. So
okay.
I think, the reason I'm involved is that they really focus on a simple message developer conference for developers by developers, and I think it's that's why I'm here every year, to get to argue with these other implementers, whether they be working on programming languages or libraries or whatever. So it's a great opportunity.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean it's a fantastic conference. Now, you guys theme these conferences out. Of course, typical Channel 9 interviews don't end when we say they're going to end. So Mike. Audience is used to this. What were some of your key themes for JAL this year? Let's talk a little bit about JAL. What were when you guys got together, wherever you get together and sit around and brainstorm, what were your themes? What was the?
Well, I think some of the themes this year. Well, we have one theme called "Real Men Don't Do JavaScript." I hate to plug it, but since I got so much hate mail, I want to stick it back out there.
Excellent.
And we had a track on cloud computing. We have some stuff on virtualization, looking in there. We've got tracks on agile development, which is a theme now with a focus this year on scalability and also some of the social issues that go in. You know how easy it is to implement Scrum teams at Microsoft and how the hierarchical managers just jump in and really support you and sort of things. So how to deal with these kind of issues at the transformation level, people talking about performance. And we also try and make sure that we can get the latest of people on what the key core technologies are. So we have an excellent set of speakers from Microsoft, including Anders and Eric, but also
absolutely
people who are on the ground, product development, and some folks talking about, you know, what's happening or not happening with Java. You know, it's moving ahead as a language. I probably should smile when I say those words.
Is Java moving ahead as a language? Seriously.
Very slowly.
Okay.
Yeah. It's difficult. When something's moving at glacial speed, it's difficult to tell whether it's moving.
Excellent.
Yeah. And also, we had quite a lot of programming language talks. There was like a programming language track, but also a lot of the other kind of talks were about programming languages or languages, like, you know, stuff about, you know, Ruby and, you know, like... JavaScript, F-sharp is not.
It was mentioned in Anders' keynote.
But it was mentioned. Anders had demoed it.
We had it in Yahoo, Australia. So
yes, in Australia we had like...
Because that's where Don Syme's from.
Exactly. So nice. We took Don to Australia and, you know, he did, a lot of talks there. So, yeah, I think it's like there's a wide variety of topics. And that, I think, is for me the nice thing. It's like, you know, there's always something new to learn and... you know, broaden the horizon.
I think one of the challenges is that all the vendors do excellent conferences. I mean, you know, the Microsoft conferences are really focused for the people they can get the basics or the depth, mm-hmm. you know, depending on whether they go to Tech Ed or the other conferences, really, you know, focused for those people. But one of the challenges is to be a professional and to get these other ideas, you can get locked in your own silo and start believing that's the only thing that's happening in the world, mm-hmm. and that inevitably puts you in a weakened competitive position.
Absolutely.
And also, if you're a professional, things change, the world's changed, and if all of a sudden, you know, you have to work in an environment, most companies have multiple platforms and multiple things, so even just the ability to know, understand the other person's technology, to be able to interop and design approaches and so on. So that's really, I think, the big feature of Yao is it's really not aligned, but it provides a fair view, and I think a fairly in-depth view.
Absolutely.
Of Microsoft's offerings and those from other vendors, be they IBM or small companies. And I think that's the big thing. Give people that are smart the latest information so they can be the best professionals they can be.
It's cool. And one of the things that I've really enjoyed being here, and I've gone to a few talks starting yesterday, actually a bunch of talks, was that on the one hand, you'd have a technical fellow from Microsoft do the opening day keynote. And then right after that, I went to a cloud computing talk by Google, mm-hmm. one of their chief architects, and he mentioned Anders and said Anders talked about this, and Anders mentioned that in his talk in a way that they get it, they understand it, they agree. And not only that, but he actually used a quote from Pat Helland. And so one of the things I'm seeing is that there's we silo ourselves from our competitors, where in reality, at the engineering level, at where the thinking really happens, no offense to the business people, they're important. There's a lot of camaraderie and respect, and I really get that here, and it feels great.
And I'm looking forward to learning a lot from the variety of tracks that are there at this JAO. Like I said, this is my first JAO, and I'm especially looking forward to this Real Men Don't Do JavaScript track. And there are two talks, one by Eric and the other by Dan Ingalls, which will illustrate some of the use cases that JavaScript is being put to, for which it was arguably not really designed for in the beginning. So I'm really looking forward to attending those talks and a bunch of others that I've kind of shortlisted. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So just to kind of, illustrate the kind of broadness of here. So yesterday in the language track, we had, on the one hand, we had PowerShell, which is for the kind of, people that do system management. And then the next talk was about Scala, which is like a super kind of, advanced research language. So these are you can probably not have more kind of extreme things. Or, you talk about people, at the engineering level collaborating. Yesterday at the kind of party, there was a Microsoft evangelist sitting next to a Google evangelist for dinner, and they were chatting.
That's awesome.
So that's kind of, and it's awesome. And so there's a lot of, and that's kind of how we move the industry forward as a whole. And I
Absolutely.
Think that's important,
Amen to that. Man.
Yeah.
Well, hey, thank you guys. And thank you for thinking up this conference and designing it.
Okay.
And enjoy this.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to get your feedback after the conference.
Thank
Cheers, you guys.
Guys.